You're listening to the Body Pros CME and CE podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. This is part of a podcast series summarizing key HIV research from CROI 2008. To listen to the rest of this series, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.
This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of The Body Pro. I'm here in Boston at CROI 2008 with Dr. David Wall, a clinician researcher who is an Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director of HIV Services for the North Carolina Department of Corrections. Dr. Wall will provide a clinically focused summary of breaking research from CROI 2008 on first-line therapy and treatment strategies.
The Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections is the most important conference regarding HIV therapeutics in our country, and I think is a really important opportunity for us as an HIV treating community to come together. Every CROI is chock full of a lot of information, and I think the challenge is for each person attending this conference to distill from the mass of oral presentations and posters the most salient data to take home to their clinic, to their practice, to their research. The one thing about this conference is it never disappoints, and I think that's true for this conference as well. There are many big studies, but there's also jewels of small studies that can be very instructive. What I'll do is try to categorize some of the data so that it's a little bit easier to understand and to try to create a theme or a story when we look at more than one study together. I'll start with studies of antiretroviral therapy in treatment-naive individuals. And there were two, I think, important clinical trials that were presented here that help us understand how well one regimen that's very popular does against another regimen that is also very popular and commonly used. The first of these studies is a long-awaited trial that looked at two of the most popular protease inhibitors that we have available and that are used clinically. One is lopinavir-ritonavir. The other is atazanavir-ritonavir. And both of these protease inhibitor giants were compared head-to-head in a very nice, well-powered study with 883 individuals who were also assigned to take tenofovir and emtricitabine, FTC. It was a one-to-one randomization. This study was done largely outside of the United States, but there were some centers in the U.S. And like most of these studies, the idea was to see which regimen gets people down to less than 50 copies after a year of therapy. This was a non-inferiority study, and a non-inferiority study is trying to prove that one regimen is not significantly worse than another regimen. And a priori, before the study is done, there are some parameters that are designed to help understand how much of a difference is acceptable to say that there's not a big difference between the two study arms. And this is one of those trials which is very commonly employed. This design is very commonly employed in this type of research. So when we look at the study, I think the important thing is that this is an opportunity to look at two very commonly used antiretroviral regimens. And for the atazanavir-ritonavir, we really don't have a lot of data prior to this. It is a preferred regimen on the Department of Health and Human Services guidelines for initiation in antiretroviral naive persons. But interestingly, we really haven't had a whole lot of data, and certainly not a lot of data about tenofovir and FTC and atazanavir-ritonavir in such a setting in large numbers of people. So this is a wonderful opportunity to see how this drug performs relative to what certainly many consider as a very potent regimen with lopinavir-ritonavir and also tenofovir and FTC. And the bottom line was that after a year, both regimens did fantastically well. We can see that the less than 50 rate in an intent to treat analysis was 78% with atazanavir-ritonavir and 76% with lopinavir-ritonavir. And the difference between those two arms was not great. And non-inferiority was achieved, meaning that one regimen was not considered not non-inferior to the other. So this shows that these two regimens perform very similarly. Similarly, when you look at the proportion of people getting less than 50 who had a baseline viral load that was greater than 100,000, both drugs performed rather well, with 72 to 74% of people achieving a viral load that was less than 50. So very reassuring data for those of us who do use atazanavir or ritonavir and have done so on almost sort of a faith-based sort of perception of that this drug will likely give the responses that we expect from other boosted protease inhibitors. Interestingly, there was an analysis done that I had not previously seen before, this type of analysis, where the patients were grouped into CD4 cell count strata, and there was an analysis looking at trends in virologic response based upon CD4 cell count. And interestingly, when you look at the persons who were on atazanavir or ritonavir, it didn't seem to matter if you were less than 50 or 50 to 100 or 100 to 200 or greater than 200. The responses were pretty grouped. There was no trend for change in response based upon this CD4 cell count. However, in the lopinavir or ritonavir arm, what we did see is that as the CD4 cell count dropped or the CD4 cell count was lower at baseline, the response was less. And I think there's a couple important things to mention here. One is that this study looked at lopinavir or ritonavir using the old capsule formulation and not the new tablet. So for the first 48 weeks of the study, people used the old formulation, and that arguably may be less well tolerated than the new formulation. So it's conceivable that some of those people in the lower CD4 cell count strata who didn't respond as well to lopinavir or ritonavir were people who dropped out due to toxicity and not necessarily virologic failure. And that's what I pretty much think is the case. Otherwise, the adverse events were pretty much as you'd expect. There was more jaundice in the patients who got atazanavir, and for those who are on lopinavir or ritonavir, there were more GI side effects. And I think, again, that might be driving what we saw with the CD4 cell count trends that were differentiated. As far as lipids go, interestingly, lipids increased basically no matter what you were on. So if there was any sort of magical thinking that atazanavir, even with ritonavir, with tenofovir and FTC, doesn't raise lipids, that should be debunked right now. You do see increases in lipids. Lipid increases were greater with lopinavir or ritonavir when it came to looking at non-HDL cholesterol. So that was something that clearly differentiated the two regimens. So you saw higher triglycerides, higher total cholesterol in those who are getting lopinavir or ritonavir. And I don't think that surprises too many people. So I think this was an interesting study. It shows that the atazanavir or ritonavir and lopinavir or ritonavir arms are both really potent regimens that people did fantastically well, as is expected with studies of this type nowadays, and that there are some things that might differentiate these drugs in the context of tenofovir and FTC, namely their adverse event profile and also the lipids. And I think that allows for more individualization of care. And so those who I think use atazanavir or ritonavir will be reassured. Those who use lopinavir or ritonavir will be reassured. But it allows us to at least understand that there's parity here, where before we just had to guess about that. Another study that I think also is very similar in many ways is the HEAT study. And this is a study that looked at initial therapy with two regimens, again, that have some traction and popularity in clinical practice. One regimen involved taking tenofovir and FTC in fixed-dose combination along with lopinavir or ritonavir. The other arm received abacavir 3TC in its fixed-dose combination along with lopinavir or ritonavir. And importantly, lopinavir or ritonavir here was given on a once-daily administration basis. This was a placebo-controlled study. Almost 700 people enrolled in this study, and they all had to be treatment-naive. The study was mostly done in the U.S., Puerto Rico. The interesting thing about this study, of course, is that there's been this nucleoside battle going on for a number of years, abacavir versus tenofovir, and this was a nice way to kind of look at this head-to-head and find out what are the differences, if any, between these two regimens. Again, as we've seen in other trials of very potent regimens, both did very well at achieving virologic suppression at 48 weeks. In this study, about 70% of people got a viral load using an intent-to-treat analysis by week 48, a little bit less than we've seen in other studies, but it's hard to compare from study to study. Importantly, CD4 cell count increases were very similar in both studies. And there really wasn't much to differentiate these two drugs. One thing that was noted is that when you look at the resistance that developed among patients in this trial, again, not too many failures, so we're not talking about great numbers, but of those who did have resistance mutations that were able to be identified, the presentation reported that M184V, or mixtures. We saw 14 of them in the tenofovir FTC arm compared to 7 in the abacavir 3TC arm. This is an unusual way to present these data, and I'm not really sure what they exactly mean. There is some buzz at the conference that these mixtures, of course, include non-M184V, but other types of mutations at that same codon. So, for instance, M184I, which can confer resistance to FTC and 3TC, and even M184A. And there is a little bit of controversy still about whether or not M184A really does lead to resistance to those two drugs. So I think that this has to be fleshed out, and unfortunately, this presentation didn't enumerate and describe these mixtures very well. So I think we have to take that with a grain of salt right now and not be too concerned about it. Otherwise, these two regimens were really pretty identical in most regards. We saw that the cholesterol changes, the triglyceride changes, really there was nothing much to differentiate between these two. Fortunately, I think in this trial, hypersensitivity reactions were fairly rare. There was a pretty aggressive strategy for identifying abacavir hypersensitivity reaction reports and then a clinician contacting sites and confirming it and talking to them about them. And I think that helped a lot in keeping the actual hypersensitivity reaction rate fairly low, with only 4% of the persons who were in the abacavir arm being diagnosed with abacavir hypersensitivity reaction. HLA-5701 testing was not done in this study. So overall, I think that this is, again, reassuring. We see that these two regimens performed very well, and that this, again, adds to some confidence with using either one. Recently, abacavir was added to the DHHS guidelines as a preferred nucleoside for initial therapy, and certainly this study, I think, adds a little bit of weight to that and is reassuring in that regard. There are other data about abacavir that we'll talk about in a little bit that I think are also interesting in the context of this study and the DHHS recommendations, but this is, I think, an important comparison. Next, another category of trials that I think are interesting to think about are protocols that have already been completed but are now being revisited. And the purpose of these secondary analyses are to understand the results that were obtained. And so in the specific case of the MERIT trial, this is a study that compared efavirenz versus maraviroc. And this is in people who are also getting combivir. And this was a very interesting study because maraviroc is an exciting compound. It's a CCR5 antagonist. And many people are interested in looking at CCR5 antagonists early in HIV therapy because that's when virus that is tropic for CCR5 is more dominant. So in this study, which has been presented previously, a large number of patients, again, were studied for at least 48 weeks. And what was the surprise story from this particular trial was that when you looked at the less than 400 endpoint, which is the primary endpoint, maraviroc and efavirenz both achieved that pretty equivalently. And that was reassuring. However, when you looked at the less than 50 copy endpoint, which was admittedly a secondary endpoint, there was a difference. And non-inferiority was not achieved. And maraviroc was considered not to be non-inferior to efavirenz, with about 65.3% of people who got maraviroc and AZT3TC achieving a less than 50 copy viral load at that time point, compared to almost 70% of those who received AZT3TC and efavirenz. So the people who were running that trial were very interested in understanding why this was and did a series of analyses to try to understand those data better. So what they looked at specifically, of course, was the tropism of the virus among people who were in the study. Everyone was screened, of course, to be R5, so you had to go and have this trophile test, and it had to indicate that you had only R5 virus. But we know from several studies now that the time frame can have a big effect on what happens subsequent to that screening test. So specifically, we know that if you get a screening test and it shows R5, some percent of people, by the time they enter the study, will have already developed a non-R5 tropic virus. So they'll have a dual or a mixed population or even an R4 virus. Now, whether or not this is a progression or an evolution of their virus within their bodies in this short period of time, or that the test initially did not pick up the R4 dual mixed populations, is not completely clear, but it seems it's more likely the latter than the former. In this particular case, that did happen. So in the case of MERIT, what we see is that there were 25 people, almost 4% of the population studied, that had dual mix at baseline. So they had virus that was a mixture, or they had both R4 and R5 tropic virus, even though they had screened for R5 earlier. So when you look at those folks, they are different. People who were strictly R5 at screening and baseline, there was no difference between the Maraviroc and a Favarans as far as getting a viral load undetectable, less than 50 copies at 48 weeks. However, when you look at the people who had the dual mixed population, 54% on a Favarans were able to get undetectable, compared to 7.1% of those who are on Maraviroc. So, of course, bottom line, it kind of goes in the duh category, that if you've got a mixed tropic virus, if you don't have purely R5, your Maraviroc is just not going to work. And so I think that's a really important lesson for us, and it may help us understand the results that we saw in MERIT and help us understand that probably these two drugs in people who truly do have R5 virus are not much different. Another component of the study that was presented here at CROI was looking at the lipid profile of those who received Maraviroc versus a Favarans in the MERIT study. And as has been reported previously, it looks like Maraviroc does not have much of an adverse lipid profile, and we certainly have accumulating data that indicate that a Favarans plus two nucleosides does have an impact. So I think, again, reassuringly, we see that Maraviroc in this treatment-naive study really had minimal impact on triglycerides and LDL and HDL. And the analysis that was done that I think is most interesting is that when you look at people who had at baseline elevated lipids, in this case LDL, those who got on a Favarans experienced even greater increases in their LDL compared to those who got on a Favarans who had lower LDL at baseline, while those on Maraviroc, you actually saw a trend towards the opposite, where no matter what your LDL was, you didn't see much of a gain. And if anything, the few people who had high LDL who got on Maraviroc, we saw an actual decrease in their LDL after getting on that particular drug. So nice data that indicate that probably the potency is there, where before we weren't able to understand it as well without understanding what the tropism was at the time that people entered the study. And the lipid profile, again, these are additional data that help us understand that it's probably a fairly lipid-friendly drug. Lastly, about this particular compound, Maraviroc has some other characteristics that might make it more attractive in other settings than the salvage setting. Particularly, there was a very nice study that compared Maraviroc concentration in the vaginal fluid of persons who are receiving it, comparing those concentrations to those of other drugs. What we see here is that when you compare vaginal fluid to blood, there was a 400% increase in concentration of Maraviroc in the cervical fluid compared to blood plasma. When you look at other drugs, very few even come close to this. Lamivudine, 3TC, does, but pretty much most other drugs achieve half the level of that seen of Maraviroc. So we see some drugs that concentrate somewhat. Indinavir concentrates in the vaginal fluid. Maraviroc is mentioned, 3TC, FTC. But there are many drugs that have a fraction of the concentration in the vaginal fluid compared to the plasma, such as many of our protease inhibitors. Lopinavir, atazanavir, sequinavir, ritonavir, and prenavir have lower concentration in the cervical vaginal fluid. So this opens up possibilities that maybe Maraviroc can be used in ways and strategies where you would want to have a lot of drug present in the vaginal fluid, such as maybe post-exposure prophylaxis, sexual post-exposure prophylaxis, or even pre-exposure prophylaxis. So really intriguing data that open up avenues for further investigation. In the same vein, another analysis that was done of a previously reported study is a presentation that was done on ACTG-5142. This is a very famous study, well-known, well-reported, comparing a Favarans versus lopinavir-ritonavir, both with two nucleosides, versus the third arm that included lopinavir-ritonavir and a Favarans together, sparing nucleosides. I think everyone that's listening appreciates that this was a hallmark study that was notable for its finding that a Favarans produced better virologic responses, while lopinavir-ritonavir yielded increased CD4 cell count gains over Favarans, and that the metabolic profile of these drugs were not that dissimilar. And in fact, if anything, in the efavirenz arm of the study, we saw more lipoatrophy. So a very important study. And what the investigators of that particular trial did is go back to the data, again, trying to understand, well, how can we find out who is more likely to not do well with these regimens? And so they did an analysis looking at a bunch of different factors. And just in brief, what they found was that virologic failure was more likely to occur in people who had lower CD4 cell counts at baseline, also among African Americans, those who were younger, and those who were female. And the trend towards women not doing as well was pretty slight. It just achieved statistical significance. And that's important because several other studies have shown that women actually do better virologically in clinical trials. However, many studies have also indicated that African Americans don't do as well either in clinic or in clinical trials. So I think this reaffirms that that is occurring and, again, lends credence to the idea that we have to really think hard about what's going on among African American study participants and patients to explain why they're not doing as well when compared to persons of other races and ethnicities. In this analysis of 5142, women had a longer time to virologic failure, however, and treatment-limiting toxicity when they were taking the lopinavir, ritonavir, and efavirenz together. So these are the people who did not get the nucleoside. So this suggests that perhaps women are more susceptible to the nucleoside-related toxicities. That has been suggested in other studies, and I think is very interesting. Not that we're going to use those data and say, well, we shouldn't give nucleosides to women, just indicates that there is likely to be more toxicity occurring in women than men to that particular class of drugs. All three regimens had a very similar time to achieving a CD4 cell count over 200, even among patients with a baseline CD4 less than 50. And again, women were more likely to experience or report symptoms, though the proportion of men and women with treatment-limiting toxicity overall in this study was very similar. So I don't think there's anything here that's going to help us in determining who we should give one therapy or the other, but I do think it raises some red flags, particularly the racial differences that we're seeing, and do indicate that we have to be very careful when we analyze these studies and make sure we do take into account gender differences in outcomes. Lastly, in this series of studies that we're looking at that revisited their data to try to make heads and tails of what they found is the SMART study. And I've argued, as many have, that this is one of the most important trials that has ever been conducted in the field of HIV. And most are very well aware of the study design and the results, namely that this was a strategy study looking at continuing on antiretroviral therapy for patients largely on antiretroviral therapy versus strategy of conserving exposure to antiretrovirals by performing intermittent treatment interruptions guided by CD4 cell count such that when the CD4 cell count was over 350, antiretroviral therapy would stop. When the CD4 cell count dropped below 250, therapy would be reinitiated. This study enrolled over 5,400 people across the planet and was stopped early with only 16 months of follow-up when it became very clear during a data safety and monitoring board review that the strategy of drug conservation or intermittent treatment interruptions was leading to more negative outcomes, adverse outcomes, including mortality, as well as other morbidity, including cardiovascular disease, renal disease, and hepatic disease, than those who continued on HIV therapy. And this really put the nail in the coffin for treatment interruptions subsequently. Well, the investigators from the SMART study have continued to work hard to try to find out exactly what was going on in this study. In addition, they've been able to continue to follow participants in this study to understand what's gone on after the study was modified and stopped back in January of 2006. So what we see is that after the news of the stopping of the study was released, very soon thereafter, the majority of people inside of the drug discontinuation arm were started on HIV therapy. So by 3 months, you get about 70% of people now on ART. And when you get to 18 months, 84%, were now on HIV therapy. This compares to the continuous therapy arm, which maintained about 95% HIV treatment rates throughout the course of this study. So this is an opportunity to look at what happens when you take somebody who is basically doing okay on their HIV therapy, stop it, and then after a period of time, restart it back. And are there any lasting effects of that treatment interruption is a major question that I think can now be answered given the follow-up time. And the answer is that there is some residual damage that's done. What we see is that even though we don't see exactly superimposable rates of HIV therapy in the two groups at the end of 18 months, we do see that among the patients who are getting treated, that there's some residual problems with maintaining a CD4 cell count climb. So specifically what we see is that among the patients who aren't smart and discontinued their therapy, those who even got a viral load less than 400 after reinitiating their therapy just cannot seem to get the same kind of responses that were seen before. So the percent with a viral load less than 400 and those who have a CD4 cell count that is increased is different between the two study arms, and this persists out to 18 months. At the 18-month time point, 84% of people who maintained on HIV therapy in the viral suppression arm had less than 400 copies, compared to 73% of those in the discontinuation arm. Similarly, when you look at the mean CD4 cell counts between the two arms, 648 among those who maintained HIV therapy versus 507 in those who had stopped and largely had reinitiated therapy by the time that this analysis was done. So I think these are sobering data and that there is some reversal of what had gone on when therapy was stopped. However, there does seem to be some lingering problems with achieving a viral load less than 400 and or being able to manifest a increase in your CD4 cell count like you would expect to have had if you maintained therapy. So this study continues to provide a lot of intriguing data, and I think really does make it clear that treatment interruptions are to be avoided, especially lengthy ones like we saw in this particular trial.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been part of a CME and CE podcast series summarizing key HIV research from CROI 2008. To listen to the rest of this series, as well as additional coverage of CROI 2008, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.